Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Master Assassins by Robert V.S. Reddick. Narrated by Eric Michael Summerer. Down the fanatic, down the clown, down, down, hammer them down. Yeats. 1. Eternity Camp. Here is the door you have been seeking. Behind it, the promised flood. Khosraji incantation. By the third day, the rumor can no longer be contained. It is whispered in the black tents, shared like smokes among the men on patrol, murmured in the drill yard before the bellowed morning prayer. It is weird and horrific, and yet a curse no one can fail to understand. Someone's mind has been stolen, and the thief still walks the camp. The signs are innumerable. The master of horses finds two stallions lamed overnight. An armory clerk displays a broadsword twisted into a spiral like a blade of grass. A cook discovers worms thick as men's fingers writhing in the belly of a well-roasted boar. And the prophet's eldest son has a toothache. These calamities, and others shared over dawn biscuits or evening rubbish fires or blazing midday marches, point to a single conclusion. The camp is under attack, and the assailant can only be a yatra, a spirit thief, which, as everyone knows, can work dark magic from within its victim's pilfered soul. Khandri Hingeman, distinguished corporal, smiles at this talk of possession, but the frowns of his fellow soldiers bring him quickly to his senses. The prophet's firstborn. Nothing touching that family is a matter for mirth. The son's toothache, moreover, has struck just hours after he announced the date of the spring offensive. And isn't the boar his gift to the soldiers, in honor of the victories ahead? Khandri tries to drop the matter. Sorcery isn't high on his list of preoccupations. They're at war. But to his surprise, the hostile looks only multiply, as though he has crossed some threshold of recklessness. Finally, one evening after final prayers, a sergeant beckons him near.
It's not you, he whispers. It's that half-brother of yours.
Mektu, sir? Khandri jumps, startling the man. What the hell has he done now?
Talk, that's what, says the sergeant. He won't shut up about the yatra, and he's got the men scared to death. It's the way he tells the stories. It's the look on his face.
Khandri understands the sergeant all too well, and that night he barely sleeps. In the morning, anxious and miserable, he prowls the camp until he locates his brother.
You jackass, he says. You'll get us killed talking like that.
They are behind a recreation tent on the camp's southern perimeter. The air reeks of cane liquor and unwashed men. An impenetrable wall of fishhook tree branches cuts off the view of the drylands beyond. It is very early. Khandri hears the flat, tireless tolling of goat bells as a herd flows around a corner of the thorn wall, and a child's laugh, and the rising chord of the fiddler trees, aerial roots rasping one on another, singing home the little brown bats that roost in their arms.
Us? Says Mektu. Of course us, Khandri snaps. The prophet knows who our father is. She knows everything about the old man.
Mektu raises an eyebrow as if to say, not everything. Khandri shakes his head.
What a pig you are, he says. I hope they send you off to fight ghouls in the marshes. I'd do a dance, I swear.
Mektu shakes his head.
You'd miss me. Everyone needs someone they can trust.
Khandri can't quite keep the smile off his face. Mektu laughs aloud, throws an arm over his shoulder, kisses his forehead. Khandri is laughing too, but perhaps he tenses at his brother's touch, for Mektu abruptly releases him and steps back.
You don't believe me.
He is a lean soldier, with a spine that is never quite straight. His laugh has something of a horse's whinny. His eyes meander like gnats. Khandri is shorter, but more sound. He has bested Mektu often at wrestling and battle dance, which are juried sports in the Army of Revelation. But he has also seen his half-brother drunk and brawling, and hopes never to fight him in earnest.
How do you know it's a yatra? Khandri demands. Bad things happen all the time.
That's the proof, says Mektu.
Each day's worse than the one before. Batali thinks it was called out of the desert by a witch. Batali's a fool. And high before breakfast. Last week he said he was engaged to a goat.
Mektu's face darkens.
It's here, brother, he says.
Then whose mind has it taken?
No one knows. No one ever knows.
What if I told you I did?
Khandri turns him a wry smile, but the look fades quickly into one of alarm.
You don't really, he murmurs.
Do you? Among the worst powers ascribed to a Yatra is the ability to sense when it has been detected. To look out through stolen eyes, read the faces around it, and know who has guessed the truth. Such persons are doomed. The Yatra will not rest until it kills them. Mektu snaps a branch from the fishhook tree fence. He draws his thumb over a long, savage thorn.
You've never faced one, he says.
Khandri bites his lips. He's heard the stories, from the time before he came to live with Mektu and the rest of the family. Absurd stories, conflicting, intractable as weeds. How a Yatra assaulted their little brother, the youngest, who still sleeps with a knife in his hand. Or was the target that spinster aunt, who set the orphanage on fire? Or their father, who rises, dresses, unlocks gates, walks for miles in his sleep? Or Mektu himself?
There's never any proof, Khandri hears himself say. I don't believe the damned things exist.
4 cases last year.
Khandri chuckles. 4 rumored Yatras in the world's greatest army. All of them elsewhere, naturally. In some mountain division or wilderness fort, never here in Eternity Camp, where the question might be settled. But perhaps this time it will be settled. The eldest son has a toothache, after all. Then he sees the flash of red on Mektu's finger, bright in the morning sun.
Never laugh at them, says his half-brother. They can't stand it when you laugh.
Many nights thereafter, in the wastes and hovels and palaces of Uroth, Khandri will lie brooding on the power of shame. What did he unleash by laughing at Mektu then? If he had summoned more patience, if he had listened to his half-brother's ravings a bit more generously, if he had simply kept his silence, everything might have been different. Even the murders, even that catastrophic night. His feet might have carried him elsewhere. He might never have glimpsed the crooked shack or heard the cries from within. He and Mektu might still be as they once were, unnoticed, invisible, far less than a footnote to this war. Imagine that, he will think, to be ordinary, to be something the world overlooks. No one's obsession, no one's idea of evil incarnate, blood traitors, spears hurled with cold precision at the gods. That evening the brothers meet again. Khandri is in their unit's dinner line, which snakes out of the mess tent and into the yard. The area is crowded with fighting men seated on stumps and makeshift benches, eating from tin plates and calabashes, waving away flies. Boys from the village hover about the edges of the yard, laughing and horsing around, waiting for the peels and bones and gristle their mothers will transform into soup. Mektu steps from the tent and approaches him, wearing an odd little smile.
Bugger off, he says.
Khandri scowls.
What the hell is your problem? You walked up to me.
Mektu shakes his head.
They're going to throw us at the Galsune again. Just us, the 8th Legion, against the same pricks who cut us to ribbons 2 years ago. I meant Krolkira. Bug over, bugger out. You're with me, aren't you?
His brother is still smiling. Khandri feels his blood run cold. He turns away, furiously composed, and walks straight out of the yard. Mektu is speaking of desertion, of bugging out. He has garbled the phrase in Khosraji, the world's dying common tongue, but then helpfully repeated himself in the language of their clan, which nearly everyone in the army speaks.
It is the act of a lunatic. Only your love, children, can light the way to heaven's path, the prophet teaches. Without that flame we are lost, all of us, and the world shall wither like a seedling in a cave. Love is compulsory. Even a dispirited sigh can mean punishment. Desertion means death by torture, live coals in the eye sockets, shards of glass down the throat.
Khandri smokes for an hour behind his legion's stables, hiding from Mektu, squatting low on his heels. Dinner is over. He won't get a crumb before breakfast, and tonight he will have to avoid the drinking areas. His brother will appear in one of them to play his allotted role in the camp, somewhere between daring eccentric and despised clown. It has always been the same with Mektu. The amusing stories, the elaborate jokes, the poetry committed to memory, lofty or obscene, the brilliant vocal impressions. Khandri's brother can draw an audience just by opening his mouth. But only a fool seeks attention in Eternity Camp. Before the Yatra panic began, there was talk of a new and horrific loyalty test, conceived by the prophet's seers in the bowels of the Palace of Radiance, a means of distinguishing between the faithful and the false. Does such a test truly exist? And if it does, how would each of them fare? I might pass, Khandri thinks. I might get that lucky. He would not. For Mektu has a gift for saying the wrong thing. You can take him to a birthday party and count the minutes until he makes a child cry. At weddings, he is apt to mention the last woman the groom has slept with. You're a lucky girl, Chelly. Just ask Sukina. Khandri once dragged him to the hospital to visit their dying grandmother. Mektu lectured her about the dangers of sunstroke and propositioned the nurse. You could only shake your head and find a way to protect yourself, of course, to help your brother without wearing him like a chain. They are not close, Khandri reminds himself. They call each other brother, dropping the half, and burn sage for their ancestors and swap shirts on New Year's morning like all brothers in the Chiloto clan. Yet what do such courtesies change? Blood means nothing, finally, and a man who pokes tigers with a stick will one day be mauled. You can take the stick away, but he'll find another. Last week, the prophet's youngest son, a boy barely into his teens, stabbed the village tailor and set fire to his shop. The old man had mended his vest with the wrong color thread. Sticks are everywhere. You have to walk about with closed fists, or they will jump into your hands. But can it possibly be true? Another assault on the Galsune? Khandri nurses his cheroot down to a lip-scorching bud. He thinks. Chindalin. That's a question for Chindalin. The Master Smith knows more about what is going on in the sprawling camp than anyone. He is no gossip. It is merely that the officers confide in him while he repairs their sabers, their bejeweled daggers and kamas and mataglins, all those distinguishing blades. They like him, those officers. He asks no favors, drops no hints about the lightness of his purse. He simply works and listens to their chatter, and no one ever learns what he overhears. No one save the brothers, that is. Khandri leaves his hiding place, wades back into the evening throng. Great rows of tents and barracks, some a mile long or more, channel the men into surging lines. In the twilight, cheers and laughter, empty bottles, ribald songs. Priests in plum-colored robes move among the soldiers, lofting shepherd's sticks. From each stick dangles a paper lamp, and within each of these fragile spheres dances an uncanny flame, some mixture of oils that shimmer from green to blue to yellow, and moan like the wind in a cave. Ghost lamps, calling to the ancestral dead, seeking their aid against the Yatra. Khandri squeezes north through the crowd in the direction of the weapons shop. Eternity Camp is a ramshackle city, a glued-together mass of shabby wards pertaining to the many branches of the Army of Revelation. At its center squats the Palace of Radiance, a hulking complex built on the spot where the last Vajek governor was hanged, ending 6 centuries of occupation and massacres for the Chiloto people. Around the palace walls, 30,000 soldiers make their homes under canvas or tin. Another 40,000 are dispersed among the various fronts.
Recently, the most savage fighting has been in the north. The prophet has taken land from the Vajeks there. She will take everything from the Vajeks one day. The brothers made the march into Vajenland during their second deployment, perhaps because they had some slight medical training, or perhaps because Chindelin had called in a favor. They were sent into the frontline carnage less often than many. Long weeks of guilt and nausea lard Condry's memories of that campaign. Prayers for the men he dragged back from the lines, prying their hands from arrows before they ripped them out and bled to death, stuffing viscera back into bellies, trying to distinguish burned clothes from skin. They were resented. In that medical rear guard, survival was more likely than not. A year later, when they fought the Galsune, there was no rear guard, and no true front, for that matter. Only doomed incursions into dry wooded hills, blundering and panic, slaughter from every side. He shakes his head. There are memories and memories, the prophet teaches. One sort is a chalice of fire and a sacrament, the other a cup of poison, drawn from black swamps of despair. He will not drink from the swamp. After all, it is a night of comforts, the first of three comprising the Feast of the Boar. The holiday is a great favorite, the army's only bacchanal. It ends on the solemn Day of Revelation, which marks the prophet's first encounter with the gods and the start of her journey on heaven's path. The mob thins swiftly, north of the palace. Condry shivers. The day's warmth is gone. The sun has set behind the coastal range. In the east, stars blaze already, untwinkling as always over the desert, the fierce, famished spider eyes of heaven. He thinks, my brother's deluded. The prophet won't make us fight the Galsune alone. We're her children. She says so. Why would she send us to our deaths? Men with torches by the east gate, surrounding a pair of wrestlers, cheering them on. Outside, on the village road, a few early prostitutes in skin-tight wraps. Touch me. Touch me. Use those soft little hands. A low voice, slippery as oil soap. Condry frowns. He knows the voice. It belongs to Skem, the wax man. There they are in the shadow of the hospital, the pusher and his unlucky whore. Condry almost shouts an insult. He loathes Skem. Quite a few men do. He has seen the effects of wax, a drug applied warm to the skin, a drug that holds off hunger and fear but makes animals of addicts, a drug that corrodes the soul. But why confront Skem? What good can it do? The camp has a dozen wax dealers, and they thrive on abuse. Condry walks on, suddenly breathless. Muffled cries from behind him. Tang of antiseptic on the breeze. He stops. Bemused, he looks down at his feet. Damned if he should be stopping. No good will come of it. Don't look back there. Just don't. He looks back. There are three people, not two, by the hospital wall. The one he took for the prostitute is in fact a man, standing beside Skem and helping him restrain a much smaller figure. A child. Condry spits out a curse and starts toward them, noisily, making his intentions plain. The men turn. Condry catches a whiff of the clove oil Skem combs into his beard. He does not know the second man. A pale, enormously muscled soldier with a bottle tucked under his arm. But the man knows him, apparently.
It's Crazy Mektu's brother, he says.
No insults, says Skem. We're all brothers here. You need a fix, Hingeman? Normally you'd have to tell me by third rotation, but you're in luck. I have plenty. Wait around the corner till we're finished.
I'm not a waxer, says Condry.
Then fuck off? Suggests the larger man.
They are holding a village boy. Gag in his mouth, pants around his ankles. The boy's white eyes turn to Condry, pleading. Skem's fingers are tight around his neck.
You can have a turn when we're finished, he says, but I'll need a few gams from you, Condry. Only fair.
Condry feels his throat constrict.
He is not a brawler, either. In fact, he hates to fight. The very prospect afflicts him with a clammy sorrow like the onset of disease. He unbuckles his machete. It hangs there, loose on his belt. He looks the big soldier in the eye. "You just step away," he says. With a lazy motion, Skem pulls the boy against his side. Fitted over his knuckles is a thrusting dagger, 5 or 6 inches long. He rests the flat of the blade on the boy's cheek. Then he glances at Condry, and his look is oddly coy.
"Do you know what I think?" he says. "I think you're a bit sentimental, Hingeman. Maybe you had a sheltered childhood, or a baby brother you were fond of. That's all right. In fact, it's sort of endearing."
"In a bitch," says the pale soldier.
"But little Faru here," Skem continues, "is nothing to any of us. A gnat, or in the words of our prophet, one leaf in a forest of flame. What's more, you don't fuck with me. Everyone knows that. Because if you do, if you fuck with the Waxman, someone calls on you in the night."
Condry stands very still. This rumor, too, has reached his ears, that Skem employs some kind of enforcer, an assassin, that is, a man who waits in darkness, cuts throats from behind, vanishes without bloodying his hands. The big man drains his bottle ostentatiously. Reversing his grip, he swings it hard against the hospital wall. The bottle shatters. The man proffers its jagged neck.
"In a hurry to bleed, Hingeman?"
Condry shakes his head.
"I don't want to fight at all."
"Who does?" says Skem brightly. "Waste of a nice fucking evening."
He taps the dagger against the boy's cheek, then bends to kiss the small round forehead.
"You'd like to get this over with, wouldn't you? Tell him, boy. Go ahead."
The child's bare legs are shaking. His eyes lock on Condry's own.
"You can't save them all, Hingeman," says Skem brightly. "Now, if you'll kindly..."
The boy's head jerks. His teeth close on Skem's hand below the dagger, and despite the gag in his mouth, he draws blood. At the same instant, Condry moves, striking Skem's face dead on with all his strength. 3 blows, half a second. Skem drops like a sack, and as he does so, Condry whirls to face the larger man. The soldier hesitates. Condry does not. Right elbow to jaw, left arm swipe, bottle blocked, right fist, left knee, down.
"You f—"
Condry kicks the bottle away, battling the urge to be sick. He hates fighting, but he is very good at it. He has killed 6 times in his 3 years in the army, but managed to finish his last deployment without killing anyone. He wants to believe he can finish his life. Skem is wheezing, spitting blood. He claws at the boy, whose teeth are still locked on his hand. Condry puts his boot on Skem's neck. Bending, he takes a firm grip on the dagger.
"Polajek," he says to the boy. "It's all right. Let go."
At first, the boy is uncomprehending, or perhaps unable to respond. Then his mouth opens and he flings himself away and is gone instantly in the darkness, a fish thrown to the sea. The big soldier lies curled in a ball. Skem cradles his hand, eyes bulging, mouth agape. Twisting his neck, he looks up in horror at Condry.
"Yatra,"
he says. Last week, Skem had held forth from his bunk. How he paid whores only in wax, how he'd massaged the drug into their scalps as he took them from behind, how days later they'd crawl back to him on their knees, give him anything, their bodies and gold besides.
"And who are you to judge me?" he demanded, although no one said a word. "I'm the same as anyone. I get pleasure where I can."
"From women too hungry or frightened to escape you. From girls so worn out from hauling water or firewood they fall asleep by the brothel door. From boys like that Faru, fleeing with the gag still in his mouth." Condry's hands are shaking. He touches the machete he never bothered to draw,
Men will sleep with village women, or foreign women from the war zones, or any women they can buy with scrip or coin or half a cabbage. Those with money even go with the Castrella courtesans, who ride in like dreams on their slate-gray stallions, galloping along the perimeter fence, swords aloft, twisting in the saddles to reveal a dark thigh, a naked midriff, taunting the men with their unbearably suggestive songs. Lust is currency. Lust is a common tongue. Condrey himself has spent money on women. You can't refuse without declaring yourself a luli. But he cannot fuck them. The moment he is alone in their brothel chambers, their squalid huts, their tents half a mile from the killing fields, the moment they light a candle and he sees their gaunt cheekbones, their fingers cracked from years at the washtub, the moment their thin flanks and worried nipples emerge from threadbare clothes, his desire makes a blushing exit. His lust vanishes like a breath of song. He is not indifferent. He wants to be there, to sit and rock these women in his arms, but to take from them. To take the least thing, a sigh, a shadow, the stroke of a hand. No, that is unthinkable. He pays what they ask for, endures their bafflement, hopes they will not talk. Later, he boasts with his comrades.
That girl Anuli with the melon ass? Oh, brother, she has fire down there. And that tongue? I shouldn't be talking. Forget I spoke, will you? Leave her to me.
He has not touched a woman since he joined the army. It is his secret agony, his private shame.
But a child. He could have killed Skem tonight with one swing of his machete. A braver man would have done so.
The weapon shop is always brightly lit. There is the yellow glow of oil lamps, dangling on chains from the roof beams, and there is the furnace, smoldering like the throat of a dragon. The broad front doors stand open, letting a little of the dragon's breath escape. Condrey pauses at the threshold. He does not wish to blunder in on an officer. Tonight, however, he sees no one, not even Chindelin. Only the small desert bats come and go, improbable acrobats, feasting on the insects drawn to the light. He steps within. The heat of the fire welcome, the night already cold. He whistles for Chindelin. They are friendly enough for whistles, though the older man will pretend to be annoyed, but no answer comes. Arranged near the furnace are the anvil, stacks of raw iron, cooling tubs, and a rough table on which Chindelin lays out his tools. Condrey moves carefully between these objects. Where can the smith have gone? The furnace is roaring. In its mouth, a length of iron glows red upon the coals. Then Condrey sees the knife. It lies on a clean blue cloth at the center of the table. He knows it at once for a mataglin, one of the huge desert knives of the Parthian nomads. It is almost as long as a machete, and it broadens near the tip, where three vicious teeth curve out like bending flames. A weapon made for beheading, disemboweling, for killing with a single blow. This mataglin, however, was clearly made for a prince or sartaf, or some other ruler of men. The steel blade is inlaid with gold in a beautiful swirling script that races from the pommel to the teeth. The pommel itself is a smooth, cream-colored wood bound with rings of gold. Small rubies, like droplets of blood, encircle the handguard, and at the base is a pale blue stone the size of a quail's egg. Under the lamps, the stone gleams like enchanted ice. Condrey's heart is pounding. He has never been alone with such wealth. How can it be lying here? Why is it not under guard? He glances left and right, then starts to turn away. But the blade is fascinating, and he will never again see such a thing. Not once, not ever. He reaches out to touch the stone.
Little bastard, get your filthy paws away!
Condrey nearly leaps out of his skin. The smith is seated at the far end of the building, copper jug in hand, broad buttocks tipping back on a stool.
Uncle, I was just trying to get your head snipped off.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?